The Guardian.
Jeremy Corbyn is back in, just not as a Labour MP. I'm Jessica Elgott, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Good morning, Mr. Starmer.
Morning, morning.
What's your reaction to Mr. Corbyn's membership being reinstated?
I put a statement out last night, I hope you've seen that. Thank you.
Will you be restoring the whip?
I put a statement out last night, thank you.
The former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was reinstated to the party 3 weeks after he was suspended for saying the party's problem with anti-Semitism had been overstated. But maybe more importantly, Keir Starmer has decided not to restore the whip, meaning that Corbyn can't sit as a Labour MP. No matter the decision, Starmer was fated to anger many in the party he had promised to unify. But how is this call likely to play out? At least he didn't have to go face-to-face with Johnson at PMQs. Well, at least not in person. The Prime Minister and six other MPs were forced to self-isolate because of a meeting held at No. 10 Downing Street last week. One of the MPs, Lee Anderson, subsequently tested positive for COVID-19. And so Johnson received that all-important alert from NHS Test and Trace, meaning he can't leave the house. Maybe he appreciated not having to meet the leader of the SNP, Ian Blackford, in the House of Commons, given the remarks by Johnson where he said that devolution was a disaster north of the border. Ministers tried to interpret what Johnson really meant, but has he just gifted nationalists across the UK an own goal? Overseas, the UK Foreign Office Minister Wendy Morton is halfway through a trip to Moscow. Later on, Patrick Winter explains the importance of such a trip after a two-year ban on such visits. And as Boris Johnson showed Dominic Cummings the door, or he resigned, or whatever, I thought it might be interesting to talk to two former special advisers who have witnessed firsthand the stress of trying to deal with the crisis in Cabinet. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Jeremy Corbyn has redeemed himself in the eyes of the NEC panel. But Keir Starmer wasn't convinced. The former leader will not be allowed to sit as a Labour MP. To discuss this and more, I'm joined by The Observer's policy editor, Michael Savage. I should say, though, that the news moved so quickly that we recorded this conversation an hour before Starmer tweeted his decision, which is just our luck. But we still get into the nitty-gritty of how the Labour Party moves forward. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining me. It's been an interesting week, but let's start with Jeremy Corbyn. He's back in, sort of back in anyway. So a five-member NEC panel decided to reinstate his Labour membership. Do we know why they made that decision?
In material terms, what seems to have happened here is in Jeremy Corbyn's latest statement, he made clear that he didn't think concerns about anti-Semitism were exaggerated or overstated. Of course, back on that day when the report came out, he made this suggestion that some of this had been overstated for political reasons. And so you can see there seems to be some movement. I mean, in reality, what's happened here is there is a ladder that everyone can climb down, and that seems to be what has happened. Of course, this really just shows the problems of having a system that isn't independent, because clearly when you have a panel of a ruling body, this is sort of terrible for criminology, which is pretty bad within the Labour Party at the best of times. You know, what are the politics of each person on the body? What faction are they from? Everything sort of very quickly descends into that sort of factional infighting that the party has quite obviously been very prone to. So, you know, part of this is really the problem of not having an independent system, which is part of what's going to be fixed in the new year.
I mean, obviously, we've heard from allies of Corbyn that they wanted to get this done speedily. They clearly didn't want to wait for the independent system. But a lot of Labour MPs aren't going to be happy with the decision, or indeed with the swiftness of it, are they?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, in terms of the happiness among MPs, which is certainly there and clear and obvious, you know, this really shows that this row was so damaging. It isn't really something you can sort of draw a line under and move on from, even if you know, act strongly as Starmer did in the first instance. You know, we're in a strange situation where during the leadership campaign, Starmer made some what you would have thought pretty innocuous promises, you know, one about unity and the other having a sort of zero tolerance policy towards anti-Semitism. Like, these should be pretty banal commitments from a Labour leader. But we're seeing, because of the way the anti-Semitism row has played out, pulled factions apart, that actually unity and tackling anti-Semitism in the way he wants to, well, it's proving, you know, not as easy and as simple as perhaps it should do. And you can see really that the forces that Starmer is having to hold together are, you know, pulling apart, even though by quite wide consent he's had a good start as leader.
So he's back as a member, but what's the significance of not restoring the whip for Corbyn?
Yeah, it's double-edged, isn't it? Clearly. I mean, part of what's going to help in the future with an independent system is the, you know, the leader can quite legitimately then say, nothing to do with me, Gov, which, of course, you know, when it comes to the party whip, you know, this is a political decision. You can't underestimate them. You take a step back, and this is a former leader who attracted hundreds of thousands of people to the party to support him. Excluding him as a Labour MP is an enormous political decision. So it causes other problems, to state the obvious. And, you know, say if Starmer did see a sudden hemorrhage or even a slow puncture of Labour members, of people leaving because of the way Jeremy Corbyn has been treated, you know, that is a problem for a party that has really swollen in terms of membership under Jeremy Corbyn. And so that is not without problems as well.
And there is obviously this independent process coming up the track, which Starmer has promised to implement within the next few months. I suppose, again, that's double-edged, isn't it? Because while a political party has a disciplinary process, it's very difficult inherently to depoliticise it because political parties are political. But also an independent process kind of just makes a leader look a bit impotent over issues that are, you know, big moral questions for the party. Is there a difficulty in having an independent process as well?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest, you know, almost the biggest force in politics is forces of unintended consequences. You can imagine, can't you, that in fixing this problem, you'll get an independent system that, you know, doesn't really, you know, weirdly talk the language of politics. It doesn't make the sort of payoffs and compromises and discussions and negotiations within a party that perhaps, you know, inter-party disciplinary processes do. Now, we've seen how that can go horribly, horribly wrong. But you can also imagine a situation where a political party loses control of its own disciplinary procedures and you're landed with decisions that, you know, senior people in the party, maybe even the leader, disagree with. And, you know, is that sustainable? Well, we're going to find out in the new year.
It's an awkward time of the week for this to happen. We're just about to see the two political leaders appearing at Prime Minister's Question Times. Only one is actually in the House of Commons. Boris Johnson is once again self-isolating after being in contact with an MP who tested positive for COVID. That was a sort of big story at the head of this Boris Johnson reset week after the departure of two of his main advisers. Do you think it's been a damaging thing for him?
Well, it again brings up this issue around, you know, the rules around meetings, business meetings, the complication of the rules, really, even in a time of much stricter, arguably clearer rules than they were under a sort of tiered system. And it also shows you that, you know, we're all involved in this, doesn't it? We've also seen clearly pictures of, you know, the Prime Minister with some of MPs, questions over whether they were 2 metres apart. Well, clearly they weren't from the pictures, but were they facing in different directions? Does this make it okay? It's just more issues that are sort of bogging the Prime Minister down around the government's own compliance to its rules, really.
I mean, on the second day of his so-called reset week, first of all, he's have to self-isolate. And then the second day of it, he's also making headlines during a Zoom call with around 60 Northern Conservative MPs on Monday evening, where he had a go at devolution, calling it Tony Blair's biggest mistake. You know, again, sort of making the headlines in the wrong way, I guess. Do you think he thought this remark would go down well?
Yeah, I think this has all the hallmarks of your sort of bog standard political blunder, really. Downing Street, of course, say, you know, what he's referring to is the mismanagement of the SNP. It was so far so innocuous. But of course, by saying devolution's a mistake, what you're doing is handing, you know, huge ammunition to, you know, not just the SNP, not just Plaid Cymru actually in Wales, but actually to all your political opponents, all of whom sort of agree with devolution, even if they don't agree with independence. And really, you know, 1,000 SNP leaflets were written this week because it just gives them some ammunition to use that the Conservatives can't be trusted on devolution. They don't believe in Scotland's ability to make its own decision. It's grist to the mill. And the timing really it's pretty disastrous. You've got, you know, key Scottish elections in the new year, next spring. If the SNP get a majority there, well, you're well and truly back into second independence referendum debate and talk. And, you know, it's not good.
I mean, it was definitely a gift to Nicola Sturgeon, but perhaps she hasn't, you know, also had the easiest week. There are, you know, now she's been announcing there's 2 million Scots, mainly in the west of the country, are going to face near lockdown restrictions for 3 weeks. Probably not the sort of announcement she would have wanted to make so close to Christmas, is it?
No, and you know, you know, apart from exercise and limited conditions of meeting limited people outside, you know, we're back to sort of lockdown in those areas and some very strict rules again. In political terms, it remains to be seen if Sturgeon can sort of maintain a level of support and trust that she's been able to, where the sort of UK government hasn't really. She's been more successful at that. But of course, coming into Christmas, everything's going to be more tense. There's going to be more pressure. There's going to be more demands. It's going to be more difficult to get people to behave in the right way. So, you know, we're really going to have to watch that. Can she maintain that sort of support through this difficult time? And we know she's an incredibly talented politician, but really no one's had to deal with this. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether she can maintain that popularity.
This is going to be a big theme, isn't it, going to the next few weeks in Scotland, but also across the whole of the UK. What's going to happen around Christmas? And how important do you think it's for politicians in all of the four nations to try and make something like a normal family Christmas happen? And what risks are they taking, I guess, in doing that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't disentangle some of the decisions that have already been made from trying to get some sort of flexibility at Christmas time. Now, some of that, you know, perhaps is political. You know, political leaders don't want to be disturbing Christmas any more than they want to. There's also a sort of practical element that clearly people are going to want to meet family, see people more, and perhaps take greater risks in order to do so. So you're having to manage those things at the same time. Of course, the Prime Minister, to be fair to him, has been very clear already that this is not clearly going to be a normal Christmas. And you know, some of the restrictions we've seen in England, as well as Scotland, before these sort of heavier lockdown restrictions came in, it wasn't that the top tier restrictions weren't doing anything. But, you know, some of the sort of modellers and people I spoke to said, look, if we just left it like that, the disease would sort of plateau at a level that would be very hard, perhaps unsustainable for hospitals. So we've seen that, you know, in order to get back some semblance of control over the disease, whether it's Christmas or not, it's about pulling it down rather than just curbing it. And I think that's why we've ended up in the place we are. Of course, even before we get to Christmas, there's a question of what happens in England when the current lockdown ends. We'll go back to some sort of regional system, but it's still not clear what that might look like.
And I guess the final story we should talk about is this quite damning new report by the Parliamentary Spending Watchdog, which shows that PPE suppliers with links to politicians or to senior officials were given this high priority channel for UK government contracts. And obviously that's leading to allegations of cronyism, you know, from activists, from senior figures in the Labour Party. And of course, Michael, we know that it's not normal times. And, you know, the Conservative MP Julia Lopez was saying, you know, obviously we need to procure contracts with extreme urgency to secure vital supplies. But this is, to say the least, not how things are normally done, is it?
There's two things going on here, aren't there? So on the one hand, there's a sort of risk versus how public money is used question. And I remember quite early on in this pandemic, I did some work around the antibody tests that, you know, the Prime Minister said were going to be game changing. It turned out with those antibody tests that in order to get a lot of them, we had to sort of pay up front, if you like, before we'd even tested them. And of course, we buy some up front, they don't work, the money is essentially wasted. And so then the question is, well, was it the right thing to do? Clearly, in a pandemic, the government's appetite for risk can and should go up. So then the question becomes around, to what degree should that risk increase? I think in this question around procurement and a sort of special channel for people that ministers and officials know, I think this is a slightly different question, because clearly the whole point of procurement processes is to stop this kind of thing. And it seems strange, didn't it, that throughout this pandemic, we've had a sort of drip of PPE contracts that had some weird or wonderful connection to a conservative figure or someone in power. This seems to explain a lot of that. And I think the wider question is the size and amount of money that has been spent without any sort of process at all, really. So the question of where that point lies, you know, the right level of risk in terms of contracts being delivered as against public money being used correctly. Clearly, mistakes have been made here. And I think one of the big questions for the forthcoming public inquiry, surely there will be one, will be around where this question of delivering at speed, delivering with increased risk, went wrong. And perhaps this channel will end up being a focus of that.
Loads to think about this week. Michael Savage, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
After the break, we look at this week's important trip to Moscow by a UK minister. And I chat to two former special advisors about what life is like when things aren't going so well for the person you're meant to advise. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. Now, on Tuesday, the Foreign Office Minister Wendy Morton landed in Moscow for the first visit by a UK government minister to the Russian capital since 2017. There has been a moratorium on trips ever since March 2018, after the poisoning of Sergei Skripal by Russian secret service agents in Salisbury. And since then, the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny was also poisoned and is recovering in Germany. The UK and allies like Germany and France believe this to have been also orchestrated by the Kremlin, although officials in Moscow continue to deny it. So what is the point of Morton's trip to Moscow? And what is the likely outcome? The Guardian's diplomatic editor Patrick Wintour has this report.
I can today tell the House that based on a body of intelligence, the government has concluded that the two individuals named by the police and CPS are officers from the Russian Military Intelligence Service, also known as the GRU.
Well, there were a series of extraordinary events in Salisbury, Wiltshire, where a Russian double agent working for the UK but had retired was suddenly found to have been poisoned alongside his daughter, Yulia. There was a huge investigation as to how he had been poisoned. It emerged there had been used a nerve agent called Novichok, which is really only used by the Russian state. And the UK then accused Russia of having poisoned Sergei Skripal and his daughter. They both survived, but two other people were found poisoned.
For 10 days, doctors at Salisbury District Hospital battled to save the life of Don Sturgis to no avail.
One of whom died when they came across a bottle that had been thrown into a dustbin containing this poison. And it led to a huge confrontation between the UK and Russia.
So we will suspend all planned high-level bilateral contacts between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation,
including the expulsion of 23 Russian diplomats and
confirming there will be no attendance by ministers or indeed members of the royal family at this summer's World Cup in Russia.
Royal family not attending the Russian World Cup as official representatives of the UK. And what was extraordinary was the UK also managed to gather an alliance of other countries that also expelled Russian diplomats in an act of solidarity and protest about the use of chemical weapons on British soil.
Before issuing ultimatums to report before the British government within 24 hours, it's better to follow your own obligations in accordance with international law, in this case with the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Well, there was a series of denials by the Russians. False trails were put up by the Russian ambassador. I remember attending very many press conferences he held in which he tried to put forward contrasting theories as to how this poisoning had occurred, and also that the Russians demanded access to the Skripal family because they went into hiding. There was a counter reaction by the Russians taking the form of expulsion of UK diplomats and the closure of UK consulate, and basically relations between the UK and Russia have been in a deep freeze.
The Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny has arrived in Berlin on a special medical evacuation flight more than 2 days after he fell into a coma in Siberia.
I mean, Russia has a tradition of using poison against its opponents and its dissidents. It goes back about 100 years. But the most recent episode was the poisoning of the most famous Russian dissident, Alexei Navalny, who in the end was flown to Germany and has survived the poisoning. But again, there have been accusations that the Russian state was involved and sanctions have been imposed by France, Germany and the UK against very leading members of Putin's entourage, because the belief is that these poisonings are sanctioned by Putin himself. The minister responsible for Russia, a woman called Wendy Morton, is going to Moscow, and it'll be the first time a UK minister has been in Moscow since the poisoning. The idea is that there's normally one meeting a year between, on a bilateral level, between Russia and the UK. They were dropped in the wake of the poisoning, and this is the first that's been held since the Skripal episode, although there was one meeting between Theresa May as Prime Minister and Putin on sidelines of an international summit, and that meeting went very poorly.
I will be very clear that I expect these individuals to be brought to justice. As I say, Russia does not allow the extradition.
Theresa May confronted Putin again about the poisoning, accused Russia of being behind it, and Putin flatly denied it. The decision's been made by the UK to have this meeting. British officials are stressing this isn't the start of the normalisation with Russia, but there are some subjects on which the two sides probably need to do business, because in particular the UK is hosting the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow at the end of next year, and Russia is one of the larger emitters of carbon in the world, and it's important to get Russia on board trying to make bigger commitments on carbon emissions than they have at present. So that's one reason for the meeting. And the other is simply to, again, stress that the UK regards the use of chemical weapons and poisoning by the Russian state as simply in breach of all norms and something that cannot be accepted.
Now, the president of Belarus has been inaugurated for a sixth term, despite an ongoing dispute over the election result.
Apart from the poisonings, there's a conflict between Russia and the UK about the future of Belarus, where the sitting president has claimed that he has won that election, and the UK says it's fraudulent. A fortnight ago, two British diplomats were expelled by the Russians, by Belarus, because they had been attending some of the demonstrations. The UK says that it's quite normal that the UK could observe demonstrations and that they were not participating, and they deeply resent the fact that these diplomats have been expelled. Well, I think it will be interesting to see what Russia does have to say about climate change and whether it has an offer to make at the UN summit. I think it will be telling also whether Russia announces that it's going to impose counter sanctions on the UK. Russia's already imposed sanctions on France and Germany, but has left the UK off the naughty step for the moment. And it'd be interesting to see whether that is just simply something that's been delayed until after this meeting, or whether the UK will be left to one side for one reason or another.
That was The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Wintour, there. Now, at the end of last week, the Westminster bubble witnessed the implosion of relations between the Prime Minister and Dominic Cummings, his most senior advisor and the man seen as crucial to Johnson's recent success. Lee Kane, the Downing Street Director of Communications, also resigned. And with that came sort of an end of an era. The vote leavers who had clung on to power inside Number 10 were out. But spare a thought, maybe, for some of the many other advisers who have spent the last week, heck, maybe the last year, trying to give advice to cabinet ministers during what is a tumultuous period, to say the least. What's it like to advise someone who really isn't having the best time of it? Is it as cutthroat as Cummings and Kane made it seem? Well, to answer that, I spoke to Salma Shah and Jason Stein earlier in the week. Salma spent several years as a special advisor to the former Chancellor and Home Secretary Sajid Javid, and Jason was special advisor to Amber Rudd when she resigned from her post in protest of the removal of the whip of 21 of her colleagues over Brexit. I guess maybe we should start with the events of the past week. Maybe there are questions about whether the media should have focused quite so much energy on staffing in Downing Street. But Salma, why do you think a story like this matters? Why does it matter that who's in these big positions of power behind the scenes?
Well, I think sort of the answer is in your question there, because there are these big, very influential jobs that actually make a difference to the decision-making process. And they are not formalised in any particular way. They are not accountable to anyone other than politicians and ministers. They are quite unreadable. You can't normally get a sense of these things. So this exposure of the cracks between advisers and how the function is running in Downing Street is not only interesting, but actually gives you a real sense of how decisions are made behind the scenes, gives you a sense that things aren't really working that well. And if it's not working well in a really centralised system of government, then it means that maybe a lot of the problems that we're seeing in policy in other areas could be down to that.
Jason, were you surprised to see it all implode in the way it did, seemingly very quickly, although perhaps behind the scenes it had been going on longer?
I was surprised because the characters involved obviously had built a formidable track record, ostensibly around winning both the Tory election campaign in June, July 2019 and the general election. So wins like that usually buy you quite a lot of time. So I was surprised. You know, all parties had seemingly managed to coexist through 2019 to get Boris elected as the Prime Minister and then, you know, to cement his place in a general election. But politics, it's a very febrile environment. COVID has obviously been an enormous challenge. And clearly, you know, like most workplaces, everything's under strain and it's blown up. But yes, I was surprised, actually, because I'd say the coalition had held together seemingly very successfully.
Jason, you were special advisor to Amber Rudd before she quit as Work and Pensions Secretary. That was a pretty febrile time. What's it like working in such a stressful environment like that?
I think you don't actually realise how mad and stressful it is until you leave, actually, because you basically function on not enough sleep, not enough personal time, and actually you make bad decisions that you don't necessarily realise at the time. You know, that's what every special advisor goes through. You're very in the moment. You're sort of wrapped up in what's going on then and there. And I think the difficulty is thinking long term, thinking strategically, giving yourself enough downtime, which you sometimes almost feel guilty about. And actually that downtime is then what enables you to be a better advisor, because you're sharper, more tuned in and more alive to everything that's going on around you. So, you know, my sympathies to everyone involved, but I think it is a reminder, actually, to sort of take time for yourself and try and look at the big picture.
Well, actually, Jessica, on that point, I think it's really interesting to note that you have lots of political advisors who, you know, their job is essentially to provide political advice. And over sort of, I would say, the last 30 years, there's been this shift from FADs providing one sort of subsection of advice to the ministers and allowing expertise to take over the rest of it, to this shift where actually the special advisor sort of becomes, you know, almost a part of the minister's thinking. So actually have accrued a lot more power and a lot more importance. The problem with that is that it hasn't come alongside, you know, massive amount of training or development opportunities for the special advisor within that position. And because it's so transient as well, you actually end up with a lot of people who haven't built up a huge bank of experience and haven't been given the opportunity to train or get training or be mentored in any particular kind of way, which then I think exacerbates the issue of stress. And certainly, you know, the ability to cope with a lot of the pressure that comes with that type of job.
Salma, you were with Sajid Javid for a long time. Does the sort of personal relationship, the kind of personal long time loyalty matter a lot? And there are some SPADs who move around to different cabinet ministers, but it's often like a personal relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, the personal relationship, actually, it develops over time. So you might go in having known the person and they trust you already. That wasn't the case when I went in to work for Sajid. So I had to develop a relationship with him. 5.5 years in, I mean, we spent more time with each other than we probably did with our own spouses and children. And so we obviously got to know each other really well. And I sort of knew what he wanted almost without asking him. And I knew what he would think about something. And then that actually helped for me to be able to help move the system and get the system sort of working to what I was pretty confident was going to be his view. And that, in policy terms particularly, that just helped that direction, you know, before things were coming up to decision for him, and indeed for ministers in terms of them understanding, you know, what he as Secretary of State might be thinking and, you know, where they might sort of deviate on opinions or where they might want to change policy. It was actually critical to be able to sort of push that through the system.
Jason, you left after Amber Rudd resigned, and obviously that is one of the key things about being a special advisor is your fate is pretty much tied to the cabinet minister that you're assigned to or working with. You know, tell us a little bit about that time, you know, having a heads up that she was going to quit and how you might have been thinking about your own job as well.
Well, in that own personal, it was very difficult. I mean, I was never quite sure leading up to Boris Johnson's initial assembling of his cabinet whether Amber would get in or not, so I'd sort of done quite a lot of thinking already about whether, you know, what would come next for me. With regard to Amber's own resignation, it was sprung quite late in the day, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, there was a conversation where Amber said to me and one of her other spads, this is what I've decided to do, I am going to resign from the cabinet and I'm going to leave the Conservative Party, and there wasn't much that you could do to change her mind. Anyone who knows Amber knows that once she's made up her mind, that is it. And at that stage, you sort of immediately turn to, right, how do we get this done? And you get swept up in quite a bit of adrenaline because there's just so much you have to handle. And then it's a bit like sort of coming off a hamster wheel after a couple of days. Everything has moved on and you're yesterday's news and you think, right, you know, that was an amazing experience in government. What do I do next? I mean, for everyone has different options. You know, some people continue to stay on in government. For example, one of Amber's special advisors remains as a special advisor in government and it's still there now. So, you know, everyone has different options, but it's quite a stressful time. Although I would say most special advisors do not find it that difficult to find a fulfilling career afterwards.
Sammy, you left on your own terms. You decided to leave government. And around that time, there was a bit of a controversy around Sajid Javid and his advisors. And he left after Dominic Cummings insisted that he fire his own team of aides and leave, you know, the decisions up to the Prime Minister about who he would hire.
Yeah.
How important is it to have a boss, have a minister who sticks up for you?
I think it's really important. But I will say this. You have to accept as an advisor that you are pretty dispensable because it's a really, really competitive world. And there's always somebody, you know, who can sell themselves in a way that would happily jump into and step into your shoes. Having said that, in Sajid's case, I think what was asked of him was over the top. If you make a big mistake, you have to try and avoid making yourself the story. So in that sense, you know, you should be dispensable. In the specific case that you're talking about with relation to Sajid and his advisors, that became kind of a political battle that needn't have been. The way advisors are used and the way advisors are sort of become political pawns are used in incredibly different ways. So whilst you have to accept, as I say, that, you know, your value is not the same as the minister's, there are limits to how dispensable you should be.
Jason, is it as cutthroat as last week makes it seem? Is that the kind of treatment that is on a daily basis, or does it only really comes out in times of really acute stress?
I think it depends on the period of time. I mean, towards the back end of Theresa May's premiership, it felt pretty rough and tumble, especially during a 2 month or 6 week, however long it was, leadership contest, which sort of pit 6 or 7 different factions against one another, like Salma and I on different campaigns both experienced. I do think, obviously, what happened last week was unusual, but there is, I found, a surprisingly little amount of collaboration and camaraderie between special advisors. Everyone has sort of their own individual friendships, but I would say actually, as a group, you know, I did find it pretty cutthroat. And I think most people are sort of thinking about themselves, their minister, their immediate issues.
I completely disagree with that. And I'll tell you why. I think it's something to do with the timing of both our experiences. So, you know, when I came in 2014, many of the other special advisors that were there who had by that point done 3 or 4 years in government, I had known from all our days campaigning together at CCHQ. And so there was this natural inbuilt camaraderie because we had all worked, you know, on the same desks for the same campaign, and we all had a single mission and we were all pulling together in one direction. Now, the natural thing that happens in political cycles, and in fact, all recruitment cycles, I think everybody in any industry can recognize this, is that, you know, over time, people go, ministers lose their jobs, people decide that they want to do other things, maybe set up a family or take their career in different directions. And all that sort of friendship and the bond and the history that you all had together, it sort of disappears. And when that goes and new people come in and you're, you know, people are replaced, you know, it's easy then to fall into your departmental silos and you have no memory of that experience of what you shared together and the sort of joy that you all felt. And in our case, in the 2010 election, where, yes, a coalition, but the first Conservative Prime Minister in 13 years. And so when you remove that sort of sense of mission, it definitely falls apart and it does become a bit more, difficult and I suppose to some extent cutthroat. Having said that, I think there is always one or two characters that sort of make it worse, just generally like to disrupt or, you know, feel very passionately about their particular thing and then are liable to kind of, you know, be difficult about it.
Jason, we have to mention that you haven't just been an advisor to Amber Rudd. You actually advised for a short time Prince Andrew and left just before that now infamous Newsnight interview. I think there's a difference of opinion over that. But more broadly, how hard is it to argue a point against people who have such positions of power? How do you make arguments to them?
My view on this has always been you've just got to be true to yourself and give as honest advice as you think, that's as considered as you think, without trying to suck up or curry favour with the person you're trying to advise. And I think in the long term, that will always stand you in good stead. And it's what I would say to anyone. You're in the room with those people because of your ability, basically, to give advice. And because at one point or the other, they trusted you enough to ask your opinion. So once you get in that room, it's my firm belief, you don't sit there quietly. You give, when asked, robust advice. And as I say, I think if you do that more often than not, you'll do okay as an advisor, in my view.
Both of you have talked a lot about, you know, the pressures that you come under, and especially now what the pressures must have been during COVID. Is it ever possible, do you think, to be a special advisor for life in this kind of political era?
Do you mean have it as kind of like a long-term job?
Yeah, a lifelong career as a special advisor, or is that never going to happen?
I wouldn't advise it.
No.
I mean, it's sort of, well, first of all, it's impossible, right? Because all you get, you might be lucky if you get a 5-year cycle, right? You might be lucky if you get that. So it's sort of, it's slightly out of your hands, really. But even if you have that longer stint in government, you know, it's always sensible to leave the party early. Because you become jaded, and actually you don't give your best advice. If you become kind of comfortable and then, you know everything about how the system works. Because there's one thing about sort of the Dominic Cummings mentality that I think most special advisors can agree with, is that you get in and you want to shake things up because you have this mandate, or certainly your ministers do, and you want to improve things and you want to see results. And the one thing that special advisors, I think collectively over political parties, will agree on is that, you know, they always feel like there's a kind of lethargy in the civil service, because of course they've all seen it before and they've seen lots of budding young special advisors coming in, and, you know, they're not impressed by us. So you've got to, before you become jaded yourself and lose that kind of sense of passion and energy, that you had for the job when you first started. You've got to go and you know, allow the departments to keep sort of running and having that sort of energy at the top of them.
In some ways, I don't actually think it's preferable to try and do a five, six, 7 year stint, not even longer. Because actually, I think when you leave, you have more time to think about things in more depth yourself. You analyze it from afar. You see things going wrong that you think, oh, actually, I think we could do that differently. And you think back to your own experiences and what you could have done. Especially if you're really into politics, you might study trends from abroad and see how things are developing there and what might be coming to the UK in terms of, you know, political philosophies and things. And actually, you can bring that sort of knowledge back in. And I think in some respects, it's just not viable to sort of sit there for 5 or 6 years because it's diminishing returns. You're not thinking strategically and long-term enough and you sort of become wrapped in your own bunker, really.
Big thanks to Jason Stein and Salma Shah for that insightful chat. But that's all from us this week. Make sure to listen to the latest episode of our sister podcast, Today in Focus, as Anushka Asthana and Katie Balls of The Spectator talk about what the resignations of Cummings and Kane mean for Britain. And as always, keep an eye on the Politics Weekly feed on Friday, as Jonathan Friedland and Manvi Singh of the Guardian US team look at what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris need to do to unify the progressives and moderates within the Democratic Party. Where have we heard that before, I wonder? But for now, I want to thank our guests, Michael Savage, Patrick Wintour, Salma Shah and Jason Stein. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jessica Elgott. Please look after yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.